F2. Number 21B.
Demonstration of the gospel is the orthodox doctrine. We can only show ourselves worthy of the signs of spirit, really, if we can preserve within ourselves a great veneration of what the signs of spirit does. If we let within ourselves just for a moment drop the bigness, the grandeur, the beauty, the sublimity of this science of God, then we are not worthy of it. We lose the tone of the science of spirit. So he asks him to watch, never to lose the beauty of science. That's how we began this summer school, and over years and years, I made more or less the rule to myself that somehow during the day, without having a plan and say, well, in the morning at 7:30 I have to think about this point. But it just begins to stay with one that one always marvels at the signs of Christianity. That one just begins to marvel that Christianity has come to our age as a science. As a science which is the comforter, as a science which is so tender that it reduces the infinite to simplicity, that science which is so grand that it is possible to be understood by everyone, no matter if he's old or young, educated or not educated, schooled or not schooled, that marvel of science is given to our age, that each one can get hold of it, learn it, understand it. So what he says here, we lose really the level of being a representative of this science if we lose our veneration for it. Keep that love for science awake. You know how in Revelation the reproach was to one of the churches, that they lost their first love. That's terrible. That's terrible. When we lose that first love for a day, you will feel it at once. You will feel it at once. When you lose that first love for this idea of science, you feel no more so happy. You feel no more so joyous. You will feel it at once that something has gone away from you. Something valuable, something beautiful has gone away from you. So let's keep that first love, and we can only keep it by always rethinking it, re-praying it, reconsidering it, re-marvel at it. That's not English, I know, but it gives you the tone. So that's what he tells Timothy. He says, just never lose the adoration, the adorable one, the adoration of what science means to the world. And in soul, he shows that he should persevere in faith, persevere in the doctrine. See, soul is always that which gives a sense of strive in the doctrine, persevere in the doctrine, endure all things. Therefore we don't let go, that we don't become slack, see, that we are always on the go in this veneration of spirit. That's so. Now, in principle, he shows that which really, wherein we should prove ourselves worthy of the doctrine, is that we work in the doctrine, that we proclaim the doctrine, that we avoid empty and worldly chatter. That's staying and honoring and preserving the doctrine, that we remain in the interpretation of that doctrine and avoid worldly chatter. Avoid, what he says again, argumentation, profane and vain babblings, foolish and unlearned questions, empty talk. He's very pronounced in the pastoral epistles about talking, about babbling on, about metaphysical blah-blah, all that he doesn't like. Have you ever read about a year or two ago, they made in the University of Harvard, I think it was, or Chicago, I don't know, it may have been Chicago, they made an inquest. You say an inquest when you... A survey, yes, about the question, how much of what people speak during the day is of no value at all, and how much is of value? I don't know if you have read that. I have read it somewhere. I always get a lot of American papers and so on. And they said there in that enquête, you say enquête, the French word, that they found out that 95% of what people speak during the day is of no value whatever, that nothing would be lost if that 95% would be dropped. You see? It may be 93, I don't know. It was between 93 and 95, that I could remember. Anyway, I thought it was not right, because I felt it's 99%. Yeah. But it's true, you see. Too much talking takes you away from God. Takes us away from God. Takes us away of being one with God, of thinking about God, of thinking about reality, of being one with reality. And so Paul was very outspoken on this subject, very outspoken. Then in life he says, that in which we should prove ourselves worthy of the doctrine is that we follow the faith, that we live that faith, that we have a deep and enriching faith, that we are a lover of that faith, you see. So, and then in truth, he goes on and says, well, that in which we should prove ourselves worthy of the doctrine is that we are doing the works of an apostle, that we are doing the works of this science, and that we express divine righteousness. And then in love, he says something very wonderful, which we must keep also, if we have that woman sense and that mother sense. He says, we only prove ourselves worthy of this doctrine if we abide by the promise of the glory. If we don't let the promise that is set on this sign, if we don't let that promise go out of our consciousness. Therefore, a mother, I like a mother. I think a mother is something wonderful, you know. I think it's wonderful because as a man, you know, one never knows what to do with a baby. And so one just wonders what the mother does with a little baby. Mother just sees that hears that he cries in the morning, and one should get out of bed and put that child again to sleep, and that the child, when it eats, all over, you see, and well, if I could talk to you in my language, I would give you a picture of it. That's how a male man feels about it, you see. And then there is a mother, and a mother just sees the grandeur of what will come out of that child, just sees the promise always, whatever happens, swaddling clothes wet or not, you know. She just sees the promise, always, and stays there. And because that mother keeps fast to that promise, that child can develop. That child can grow naturally, happily, and gather everything which man needs. And that, now our child is the idea of science. And that idea of science today in this world is so tiny, insignificant, full of all sorts of shortcomings and weaknesses and so on. It doesn't matter. if you are a mother to that idea, we know that fundamentally that idea is right. We know fundamentally that idea is enormously big. We know it. So a mother just isn't bothered about all what's happening humanly about it. Just keeps to the idea. That is what we as a church leader, if you would call it like that, as a Timothy, you see, as a representative of the universal church of science, we should express. And we have to prove ourselves worthy first in this attitude. So it's good to go over those seven tones, you see, and see for ourselves in what attitude we should prove ourselves worthy in respect to this doctrine, in respect to the idea of science. Then Paul says always that preserves the idea, that preserves it. Here's another letter which he writes to Titus, also one. Oh, no, I must show, yes, just the end of 2 Timothy is such a fine passage, because somehow there are the last words of Paul at the end of his life, of his work, and I think it's good to remember what he says. He writes to Timothy and says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. What a statement for a man who sees the end of his life, can say, I did a good job. What good job? I kept faith. I did stick to that doctrine of Christianity. And in that attitude he sees really the reward of his life work. Because humanly seen, the reward was pitiful. There he was in prison, facing death. It was in the time of Nero. He said, henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, because he was before a human judge in Rome, and he knew what the human judge would say. But he didn't think about that. He was thinking about the Lord, about the righteous judge. And he shall give me at that day, and not to me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing. That there is a righteous judgment to all who keep that faith, as Paul did. He asks at that moment for his parchment, for his books. Said, Timothy, send me the books and the parchments. See, he just asked for science. All he wanted is that idea of science, that which represented the idea of the doctrine. Then he says, at my first answer, that was when he was tried before the judge, at my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. Well, we have to face that. We have to face that. Notwithstanding, the Lord stood with me. See, he really finished what through with the world. He was through with the world. He could see it doesn't matter if everybody forsakes me or not. That doesn't matter. The Lord stood with me and strengthened me. And then he goes on, that by me the preaching might be fully known, and that all the Gentiles might hear. And further down he says, the Lord shall deliver me from every evil work, and will preserve me unto his heavenly kingdom. He could see again that his standing unwaveringly for the faith would be a preserving power for him unto the heavenly kingdom. He gave the example of that. Well, humanly seen, one would say it didn't work, because humanly seen, apparently, he was beheaded right afterwards. But divinely seen, it's right. Divinely seen, he really was a savior to the world, and he fulfilled his mission, as nearly no one else of Jesus, no other disciple of Jesus did. So, he really was seeing through human righteousness, and could see that human righteousness would never, never, never justify divine righteousness. That we have to find our satisfaction, our justification in divine righteousness, and never in human righteousness. So let's just keep our heads above the human plane of thinking, above human doings, above human likes and dislikes, above human being acknowledged or not acknowledged. All that doesn't matter. If this idea should really make the grade, it must pierce through that wall, that barrier of measuring everything in a human way. The fourth side of the city is the signs of it. And that signs of it can never be measured by human standards, never by so-called human demonstrations. Can always only be measured by divine facts, by divine demonstrations, by divine righteousness. And we must see that, or we get discouraged. Then we come to Titus. Titus is in the Isle of Crete. He had an easy job there, because the Cretans were always liars, vicious, brutes, and lazy gluttons. That's how a poet at that time described the Cretans. Would you say the Cretans? Yes, Cretans. So their Titus was not to deal with that lot. So Paul asked him also to be a good example of the Christ, to embody the true doctrine. Ask him to show himself in all things a pattern of good works, to be ready to every good work, to maintain good works. Purify unto himself. He just asked him to stand as a representative of science. Says that's the way how you can achieve anything in Crete. So teaching by example is something which Paul sets very high, much higher than teaching by words. The good example, he feels, really has that influence on everybody that can spread Christianity. So his message to Titus is to show fundamentally that by embodying the true doctrine, that has within itself the power to spread Christianity. How does he show that? You know how really what he says there is just the opposite of what I do. I talk to you, see. But really, you see, we begin to see talking is just waking up something in us to the realization to be something. And I think that's all what teaching and lecturing and can do. Just to wake up in somebody the realization that we have to be the idea of science. And so really, that then being the idea of science really has power. Not the talking by itself. It's not my saying things to you that has any real power in itself. But the Christ sense that is working through an interpretation wakes up in man something which says, all right, I see, I have to be, I have to embody this idea of science. Then Paul says, if we do that, if we are embodying the idea of science, there is power. Therein lies power. That spreads Christianity. Mrs. Eddy, for instance, says right at the beginning of the textbook, you know, she says, prayer, watching, and working. She doesn't say talking. Prayer, watching, and working are God's gracious means. And then she goes on to accomplish whatever is successfully done for the Christianization and I think health of mankind. See, she gives, I think, in that sentence, that tone of Titus, where Paul said, it is what you are that does something successfully for the Christianization and health of mankind. It's praying, watching, and working. So I become more aware how limited my work is when I speak, when I lecture, when I express the truth in words. It's the being of it that really has power. So in Titus he shows through seven subjects how to embody the idea of God, and how by embodying the idea of God, how that has a saving effect on mankind and the universe. Now we get again that sense, well, what happens if we embody the idea of science? And he says, well, that has quite a influence on the whole world. In mind, he shows that by holding fast to the word, usually always when the tone of mind with him is holding fast to the faith, you see, to be lawful to the idea of science. And he shows, if you hold fast to the true faith, to the true doctrine, he says, that has a guiding and saving influence on everyone. It exhorts and convinces, and it shuts up the gainsayers. Then he says, in spirit, he says, well, if you are pure and strong in that doctrine, if you are pure and strong, you see, spirit is purity and strength. If you are pure and strong in your doctrine, that's something which has an effect on the world. And it says that it has a purifying effect on everybody. See, you see how he begins to see that whatever we embody, now, like this, that if we embody an idea, if we don't embody anything else but the idea of God, see, that's the fourth side of the Holy Spirit. If you embody an idea of God, well, idea is idea everywhere. Idea is not me, is not here, has no time, no space, no person, no place. Idea is idea. It's everywhere. Therefore, what we embody as idea is embodying something which has a universal effect. It can't stay at a certain place or person or body or time or anything like that. It's always idea. An idea is timeless and spaceless. He says that if Titus is a sinless exemplar, and that all his church members would be sinless exemplars of the doctrine, that would stir others also to try to emulate that science, and that it works, so to say, as a silent rebuke for error everywhere. That's what you feel, you see, that whatever you embody in the way of divinity, in the way of idea, that that is always a rebuke to everyone else who has not embodied that idea. They just don't like it. They just don't feel happy around you. They get irritated around you, you see. Every idea just silently begins to rebuke something in everyone. And therefore, if that someone doesn't like it and resists it, they just don't like it. Then they hit back. But that doesn't matter, really. But the main thing is that it shows that it has a universal influence as a sinless influence. Then it shows as principle that by embodying the idea of principle, we embody that wonderful ability to subject ourselves to God unconditionally, to be principle-minded, principle-like, and therefore to let go everything of our human self. And it says that that works in you, in the universe, as an educative influence, as a disciplining influence. It begins to discipline all around you. Then he shows as life is life's ideas are mercy and grace and the gift of life. So if you embody grace, that is the idea of life, if you embody grace in our life, that has a supporting and uplifting influence and gives hope to everyone. And you feel that so much, that everyone who has within himself a positive, constructive attitude, that somehow he has an atmosphere around him that just takes the other ones on and on and on, and gives them hope and strength again and Zuversicht. Well, what is Zuversicht? Hope, you see, trust, and again, once it gives a sense of, let's go on, there is a way out, let's go on. Then he shows as truth that if we represent the word of truth, that has a very good influence, namely that if we do the works of good, it always awakens in each other one the desire to be able to do those works too, to emulate also those works. He's not very much for conversion in that paragraph. He didn't think much about conversion. Said, well, you can tell the truth to somebody, but he doesn't listen once, well, let him go. Error will fall to pieces by itself. He didn't feel that we should spread Christianity by trying to convert it. He said, no, spread Christianity by embodying the idea of truth. That's how you spread it. Oh, that conversion, you know, I don't know how it is here. Thank God I don't know the situation here, so I can speak very frankly how it's at home, you know, without trying to hurt anybody. But at home, all the women try to convert their husbands. All of them. They come to the classes, listen to the talks, and say how wonderful it is. The next thing it is, if I can only convert my husband. All right. And then they do exactly the contrary of what Paul said. They talk to them for morning, noon, and night until marriage nearly goes to pieces. Some cases, it nearly went to pieces. I was to blame, naturally. I taught them. Yeah? And every time I could, that wasn't easy, I could convince these wives of these husbands to shut up.